Have you ever wanted to learn a new language, but just didn't have the time or money? I may have a solution for you. Her name is Jessica, and she gives free Chinese lessons daily at 11 p.m. Beijing time and 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Chinese is fun and easy if you have the right teacher. Let Jessica be that teacher and introduce yourself to the fastest growing language in the international job market today at tinyurl.com/tcjessica and tell her Ian sent you.
Do you like fine art but think it might be out of your price range? Do you have a vision for a painting that you'd like to see brought to life but you just don't have the skill? I might have a solution for you. Art by Daisy. With decades of experience, Daisy offers high-quality, affordable watercolor paintings suitable for hanging in your home, office, or even as a gift. With prices starting at just $55, visit tinyurl.com/artbydaisy to find out more. Hello, and welcome to the Deathcast, the place where the cool, creepy kids come to do their deep dive true crime. I'm your host, author, and journalist, Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our sixth and final look at the crimes of Leonard Lake and Charles Ng. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for The Deathcast, Deathcast Official, or Deathcast Pod. You can find me on no social media platforms under any one of those monikers. If you'd like to help support the show, you can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to buymeacoffee.com/thedeathcast and make a one-time donation. And lastly, you can go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows as well as exclusive content. This past week, I released the newest episode in the Vince McMahon saga, where we discuss new twists and turns in that case, as well as the steroid trial in the early 1990s that nearly put him behind bars. And as always, when discussing Patreon, I have to give a shout-out to my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony. Thank you guys so much. You're awesome. Alright, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! We left off last week with officers investigating the cabin in Wileysville, California. Leonard Lake is in a coma in a hospital in San Francisco after ingesting cyanide tablets. And Charles Ng has flown the coop. It took the detectives more than a month to process the entire crime scene in Wileysville. And a big part of this processing was the bunker that Leonard Lake and Charles Ng had constructed. Inside it, they learned that for the most part, it was a tool shed and a workshop filled with various tools that you would expect to find inside of this type of structure. Upon further inspection, however, officers found a wall that was covered in photographs of naked or nearly nude females. Eventually, officers would be tasked with tracking down each of these women to find out whether or not they had actually been a victim of Lake and Ng. One of the things that immediately stuck out to these officers was the fact that the interior dimensions of the bunker did not match the exterior dimensions, meaning inside was much smaller than the outside would lead them to believe. At first, officers were scratching their head. They quickly saw, however, piano hinges attached to a section of the plywood wall in the back of this tool shed slash work area. They waited until they got a second search warrant that specifically included this area before going into it. Now, in the interim, Leonard Lake ends up dying in the hospital without having regained consciousness. Once the officers had obtained this second search warrant, they opened this door and found a passage beyond that led to another area that the officers labeled as the living area. There was a bed, a table, a lamp, a desk, a dresser, shelves with food storage, as well as various other items. One in particular was a copy of the book The Collector by John Fowles. Obviously, the officers are going over this area diligently, and at the back half of this room, they realized that the back wall was yet another partition, and inside of this was a room that was 3.5 foot wide by 6.5 foot long. There was a platform in it that was about 2 foot wide that a rubber pad lay on, which they later assumed was a bed. There was also a 5-gallon plastic bucket and a roll of toilet paper inside this room, and the walls had been soundproofed. Officers also noted that a one-way mirror had been installed on the wall facing the living quarters looking into the cell. On one wall of this cell, officers found a piece of typewritten paper that stated, quote, rules. 1. I must always be ready to service my master. I must be clean, brushed, and made up with my cell neat. 2. I must never speak unless spoken to. Unless in bed, I must never look my master in the eye, but must keep my eyes downcast. 3. I must never show my disrespect, either verbally or silent. I must never cross my arms or legs in front of my body or clench my fists, and unless eating, must always keep my lips parted. 4. I must be obedient completely and in all things. I must obey immediately and without question or comment. 5. I must always be quiet when locked in my cell. 6. I must remember and obey any additional rules told to me. I must understand that any disobedience, any pain, trouble, or annoyance caused by me to my master will be grounds for punishment. Obviously, the officers knew that it was a cell of some type. They did not know exactly what this cell was for, but they quickly learned the nature of it when an area of soft ground beside the bunker was dug up and a 5-gallon bucket was discovered. According to the evidence log, it contained, quote, several photo albums which depicted different white females in various stages of undress and completely nude, a journal, and 2 videotapes, one with a label M on it and the other with the label of M-Ladies, Kathy/Brenda. Officers watched these tapes, and in it they saw Kathleen Allen being forced to massage Charles Nung, directed about the house as Leonard Lake took pictures in her, having the conversation that I described in the previous episode. Further on the second tape, they found footage of Brenda O'Connor. And I'm going to read you here from the officer's report, which was reprinted in Die for Me, The Terrifying Story of Charles Nung and Leonard Lake by Don Lasseter. Quote, in the opening shots of the tape scene, Brenda O'Connor sits in the same brown chair Kathy Allen had used, with the same backdrop depicting a mural of forest in fall colors. On a table to Brenda's right, a lamp provides muted light. She is dressed in a long-sleeved tomato red jersey with a white bodice and blue jeans. Her light brown hair is cut in a page boy, and she is without makeup. Her hands are cuffed behind her. Leonard Lake's voice breaks the silence, apparently answering her question about what happened to Lonnie Bond and Scott Stapley. Well, if you must know, I didn't do anything with them. Brenda asks, apparently for the second time, what did you do with them? Her voice is soft but firm. I didn't do anything with them. Did you guys kill them? No, we didn't kill them. Are you going to let us go soon? Probably not. Brenda then asks, never? What are you going to do, kill us? To which Lake responds, that's sort of up to you, Brenda. Charles, what are you going to do to us? Why are you doing this? Lake responds, because we hate you. Brenda, what did we do to you? Lake, shut up. What a hairy day. Brenda, gotta get my baby down here. Lake, your baby is sound asleep, like a rock, Brenda. The neighborhood doesn't like you, the neighborhood doesn't like Lonnie, and we haven't liked you since you moved in. Brenda, so we'll leave. Lake, oh, you've already left. We're closed you down. We got together and we took you away. We got Scott away. Lonnie's going to earn a decent living for the rest of his life, hopefully. Brenda, I know he is. Lake, your baby is going to be taken away. Excuse the heavy breathing. Brenda, what do you mean gonna be taken away? Lake, there's a family in Fresno that doesn't have a baby. Brenda, you're not taking my baby away from me. Lake, they've got one now. At this point, Charles Nung, dressed all in black, comes into the room and says, it's better than the baby is dead, right? Brenda, what do you mean they've got one now? That's my baby. Lake, Brenda, you have a choice. We'll give it to you right now. Brenda, what? Lake, you can cooperate with us. By cooperating with us, that means you will stay here as our prisoner. You will work for us, you will wash for us, you will fuck for us, or you can say, no, I don't want that. In which case, we'll tie you to the bed, we'll rape you, and then we'll take you outside and shoot you. Your choice. Brenda, I'll cooperate. Ning, that's wise. Lake, that was fast. Ning, very wise. Brenda, are you really going to take my baby away from me? Lake, yes, we are. Personally, I don't think you're a fit mother. Brenda, where's Lonnie? Lake, they've been taken away. There's a place up in the hills where they're split wood for the rest of their happy lives. Brenda, you mean you haven't killed them or anything? Lake, no, I haven't killed them. Although if they die, that's their problem. To be honest, I could care less. They had better cooperate, too. They're getting the same choice you're getting. To be honest, for all I know, maybe they are dead right now. Brenda, is that why you invite us over for dinner? Lake, uh-huh. Ning, it's part of the game. Lake, you guys have been such assholes, Brenda. You know Lonnie hasn't been all that bad, I'll give you that. Except for his shooting, but you've been an asshole like I can't believe. You've been so damn rude and for no reason that I can figure. Brenda, because I can't stand it up here. It's the middle of nowhere. Lake, ah. A few moments later, Brenda asks if she's going to be kept there for the rest of her life, to which Lake responds, no. To be honest with you, I probably won't keep you here for more than a few weeks, but after that we'll probably pass you around. There's others. Brenda then states that the lamp is hot, and Lake states, suffer. There's people that are going to want to know what we did our job. There's already some guys that took Lonnie and Scott away. Brenda, why do you guys do this? Lake, we don't like you. Would you like me to put it in writing? Charles, it's done. Just take whatever we tell you. Brenda, I can't do this. Lake, we're going to sit back and enjoy ourselves. It's been a hectic day and you are going to learn the true meaning of fuckface. Charles, uh-huh. Lake, where are the manacles? Charles, the manacles, yeah, at which point he pulls out ankle clamps, along with a piece of chain. Brenda then asks if they can loosen her handcuffs. Lake informs her they'll be taken off in a moment. She then questions them about Lonnie, and Ning moves in front of her, stating that since she's hot, he'll remove her clothing for her, at which point he begins to rip her clothing from her body. Lake, sounding amused, states that she could take it off herself. There's some back and forth between Lake and Nung as Charles continues to remove Brenda's clothing. Brenda begs for the return of her baby, and they tell her that she's not getting the baby back. More back and forth, Nung pulls a knife and cuts away the rest of Brenda's shirt, says, let's see what we're buying. Brenda asks if they're going to sell her. Lake informs her that they're not going to sell her, they're going to give her away. Ning then uses the knife to cut away Brenda's bra and informs her, quote, "Nothing is yours now. It'll be totally ours." Lake then instructs Nung to remove her handcuffs. Nung leans over her to remove the handcuffs and informs her, "Okay, you can cry and stifle like the rest of them, but it won't do you no good. We are pretty hot, cold-hearted, so to speak." Lake then says that he's feeling pretty hot, asks if Charles has removed the handcuffs. Charles says that he has, and then informs Brenda that he's going to get his weapons handy just in case she decides to get stupid. She insists that she will not, and Lake orders her to stand up twice. Out of camera range, Lake holds up something and asks Brenda if she sees it. She asks if she is going to be beaten, and Lake informs her that her options are either full cooperation or punishment. Brenda states that she will go with full cooperation. Lake asks if she's ready for her shower. Brenda is confused at this point. Lake informs her they're going to clean her up. Lake states they're both going to take a shower, and Nung leads her from the room. Nung says, "Yup, I always do that. It's luckier." Lake states, "See, Charlie owes me one, so I get you first. But he's got his heart set on taking a shower with you, so who am I to turn him down?" They then order Brenda to remove her jeans and her underwear. She says she's dizzy, so they agree to allow her to sit on the couch, stating that's probably the lamp. Lake then says that he has a lot of animosity towards her and would like to whip her. They order Brenda to remove her pants again. She is resisting, and at that point, Lake comes back into camera view holding a handgun with a silencer. There's then some more back and forth. It's agreed that the light will be turned off in the living room and a different light will be turned on. Lake then begins to fondle Brenda's breasts, and they comment on her body. There's more conversation. Brenda says she might be pregnant. She doesn't want to have the baby. They inform her that's not the right time for this, and then Nung picks up what is assumed to be a stun gun. Lake states, quote, "Well, we've told you what's going to happen to the baby. Just don't ask us or else it'll be history, so I don't want to hear nothing about it. We'll be taken care of." Brenda then begs for her baby and is informed that she's going to do what they want, whether she likes it or not. They then order her to remove her clothing, which point they escort her from the room. There's more conversation, and the video ends with Charles Nung complaining about the shower in the bathroom not working. All over the property, the officers found evidence of digging as well as fires. And because of this, they decided that these areas were the most likely areas outside of the cabin and the bunker that they should focus their attention on. Search and rescue dogs are brought in, and during one break, one of the dogs wanders off and returns with a human bone. Officers also discovered a sheet of plywood lying on the ground. On top of this, they saw ants carrying maggot larvae. Beneath this, they found sections of bone fragments, including a piece of a human spine, as well as human teeth. Eventually, they're going to find thousands of bone fragments, which were later determined by the county medical examiner to have been cremated. Now, in the trenches near the house, they found the body of what appeared to be an African-American man that had suffered from animal predation. 101 feet away from this body, they discovered another one. This body turned out to be Maurice Rock, with his ID being discovered at a different location on the property. Inside of the house itself, they found evidence that Cheryl Okoro had been there in the form of pictures showing her standing on the deck behind the house wearing handcuffs. Eventually, the only thing that would physically prove she was there other than these pictures was a piece of leg bone and a part of a vertebrae that was identified as belonging to her through DNA testing. Other items discovered buried around the property included various sealed packages containing valuables and a 5-gallon bucket that contained multiple ID cards, social security cards, bank books, etc. that all belonged to Kathy Allen, Mike Carroll, Randy Jacobson, Paul Costner, and Jeffrey Gerald. They discovered the sun visor from Paul Costner's Honda buried in one of the trenches with a bullet hole in it. And it was theorized that he had been shot from somebody riding in the back seat of the car. A body was found near the chicken coop, that of Randy Jacobson. His cause of death was later determined to be cyanide poisoning. A human liver, which was determined to have come from a child, was discovered on the property. However, the age and ID of the victim was never proven. More videotapes were discovered. On one of them, it was found that if the tape was rewound, an image appeared showing two bodies lying in sleeping bags inside of a wheelbarrow. Numerous personal effects were found inside of the home, including the camera belonging to the Dubs family, which still contained footage of the family on it, personalized license plate, guitars, mirrors, statues, candlesticks, holders, ceramic fish, and the typewriter that was eventually matched to letters mailed to various family members of the victims. Officers kept investigating, and a month after the search initially began, on July 8th, an officer on patrol about a mile from the house noticed an area off the side of the road that appeared to have been freshly dug. And eventually, it was discovered that two bodies had been buried there, wrapped in sleeping bags. Obviously, these were the sleeping bag-wrapped bodies that the officers had seen briefly on the video cassette. Both victims had been shot from the left side behind the ear. One of the bodies was Scott Stapley, the other that of Lonnie Bond. Both had been secured using duct tape, had ball gags put into their mouths, and were wrapped in trash bags inside of the sleeping bags. And unfortunately, officers would not discover any more bodies on their property or around the area. However, they left with the five bodies that had been discovered, mountains of evidence, as well as 45 pounds of bone fragments, which experts later stated was the equivalent to about 25 bodies. And as all this is going on, the officers are wrapping up their investigation at the cabin in Wileysville. Charles Nung gets arrested in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Later, Nung would state what had happened on the day that he and Leonard Lake were discovered. He had contacted Cricket after leaving the lumberyard, stating, quote, "I told her what happened, that Leonard might be busted at the South City lumberyard for shoplifting, and asked her to drive me down there to check on him, see if he was okay. We jumped in her car and drove to the lumberyard." He said that Cricket informed him as he lay in the back seat that she could see Lake drinking a soda surrounded by police officers. After this, she drove him to a bus station, at which point he contacted an aunt stating that he wanted to go on vacation but had not yet received an overdue paycheck from one of his employers. His aunt picked him up at the bus station, gave him $400, and drove him to his apartment in the city. with his aunt standing outside, Lake called the owners of the moving company he worked for and stated that a friend of his had committed suicide in Hawaii and that he needed time off. He then packed a suitcase, and his aunt drove him to San Francisco International Airport, stopping along the way for Lake to mail a package which contained guns. Lake then traveled by airplane to Chicago, picking up the package containing the guns that he had mailed to himself at a friend's home. Lake stated he spent 4 nights at a motel before his friend drove him to Detroit, at which point Leonard Lake crossed over into Canada, where one of his sisters lived. Obviously, with Lake fleeing and the discoveries in Wileysville, an international APB was put out for the apprehension of Charles Nung. It's been suggested, although never proven, that he had stayed at his sister's home in Calgary. It is known that he created a lean-to for himself in one of the city's parks. He was discovered by two boys who saw this lean-to and told their parents, who in turn contacted the police, who arrived only to discover that Nung wasn't there. On July 6th, two men were inside a department store working as security guards when they noticed a short Asian man slipping a, quote, tin of salmon into a shopping bag. One man went behind a wall to look through a two-way mirror. The other shadowed him through the store as he continued to shoplift more items. Outside of the store, Charles Nung was arrested. Inside the backpack he was carrying, they discovered a .22 caliber handgun, at which point the officers tackled him to the floor. During all of this, the officers stated that Nung fired 2 shots, with one hitting nothing and the other hitting one of the man in the finger. At which point, the man who had been shot was able to get the gun away from Charles Nung. At this point in time, the Calgary police arrived and took Charles Nung into custody, where he was booked on attempted murder, robbery, and possession of a firearm. In his jail cell, Nung attempted to kill himself using his soiled underwear, and officers were able to get these from him, leaving him in his jail cell. Quote, Nung decided to take his own life using his soiled underwear. Nung tried to hang himself, but was stopped by guards who took the shorts from him, leaving the suspect naked in the cell, depressed, suicidal, and fearful. Searching his campsite, officers found a camera that would later be traced back to Robin Scott Stapley through a serial number. Stapley had purchased this camera in San Diego. A towel that was also discovered at the campsite was later traced back to a set of towels stolen from the home of Clifford Perantu's apartment in San Francisco. Nung refused to cooperate with Canadian authorities at first, and he was listed as being highly suicidal and kept under constant watch. Obviously, officers end up going to Calgary. Obviously, Charles Nung tried to pin everything on Leonard Lake, stating that in regards to Paul Cosner, quote, Nung initially stated that Lake told him he'd bought the Honda from some guy and had to install new seat covers. At a later point in the interview, he stated that Lake shot Cosner in the Honda. Nung claimed that he'd waited on a street corner, and that when Lake arrived to pick him up, the body was lying in the passenger seat. That Lake had told him the first shot had missed hitting the sun visor, and that he had helped move the body into the car's trunk. He then stated that Lake had driven to Cosner's apartment where 2 guns were stolen, but that Lake had fled the area when a ringing telephone scared him off. He said that when they got to Wileysville, they had buried Cosner's body in a pre-dug hole about 1 mile from the cabin in a torrential downpour. Charles Nung stated he had no involvement in the disappearance of the Dubs family and that it was all Leonard Lake. His reason for not being involved, he said, was because of the baby, which we know from other crimes as well as from witness testimony is a lie, as Charles Nung is the individual who is seen at the scene of the crime. He then implicates Cricket, claiming that Lake and Cricket had gone out to eat at a restaurant and used the man's credit card, with Cricket signing the receipt. He also stated that he did not really know anything about Charles Gunner or Donald Giulietti. He stated that his co-workers had simply left and that he had wanted to move past them in terms of seniority at the job. He then stated that it was Lake's idea that both men should be brought up to the country and that he had facilitated this. Concerning Michael, Carol, and Kathleen Allen, he said the last time he had seen Kathleen, she had been alive at the Wileysville Lake, and that she had driven him to the bus station Wileysville before later being informed by Lake that he had taken her for a walk. He refused to discuss the Bond family, with the exception of the child. He stated that Leonard Lake had killed the child, quote, putting the baby's head between his thighs and twisting the upper body. He then allegedly told Lake, quote, if you want to kill the baby, make sure it doesn't suffer. He basically ends up denying any active part in the killings, and later refused to talk with the detectives when they brought a tape recorder in, stating that an attorney had informed him it would be in his best interests not to cooperate with police. Obviously, the United States is going to try and extradite Charles Nung to the United States to face charges on murder. There is a major obstacle in this, in that Canada outlawed the death penalty in 1976, and law in the books stated that they could refuse to extradite anyone to the United States to face trial should that individual face the possibility of the death sentence. Eventually, they're going to get around that, and he is going to be extradited. However, that is a long, long way coming. First, Nung goes on trial for the crimes he committed in Canada. On December 18th, 1985, Charles Nung was found not guilty of attempted murder, although he was found guilty of assault and robbery and sentenced to 4.5 years behind bars. The state of California charges Charles Nung at this point with kidnapping, false imprisonment, burglary, and unlawful flight. Nung is placed in an isolation cell, and he ends up befriending the man in the cell next to him, Maurice Joseph Laberge. He's a career criminal who is known to have committed various vicious acts. In one instance, he sexually assaulted a 15-year-old boy in a home that he and a friend were burglarizing. He ends up being convicted on November 26, 1982, and sentenced to 25 years of imprisonment. And this man is eventually going to learn over the passage of time just what Charles Nung had been involved with in the cabin in Wileysville. Obviously, we should take his words with a grain of salt, as he is a violent convicted felon. However, at the time he was placed into solitary confinement, news of what Charles Nung was really accused of hadn't gone completely worldwide yet. It was really relegated to the United States. Yes, obviously there were news reports, but it wasn't the type of thing that it would be in this day and age were an accused serial killer to be arrested outside of the United States and held in police custody. To quote Laberge, I would receive cartoon caricatures from Charles depicting what we had talked about. When I had 12 or 15 of these pieces of paper, I would seal them in an envelope and send them to my lawyer. I think there were in the neighborhood of maybe 115 cartoon caricatures. These were pictures that Charles drew of the things that he and Lake had done in Wileysville. He stated that Nung had expressed worry over videotaped abuses that had occurred in Wileysville concerning two women. Again, quoting LeBrage, I asked him what exactly it was the police would see on this videotape. It had to do with Kathy Allen and Brenda O'Connor, two girls who Lake and Charles Nung had kept for some time in a cell at Lake's Acreage. He told me that the tape shows a female complaining that it is too warm and that he had a butterfly knife, he called it, and he flicked it open and cut her clothes off. He told me that he went into the shower. This thing had actually taken quite a bit of time. One of the things he did is stopped and made something to eat, made himself some rice, and actually came back to eat the rice while Leonard Lake was carrying on with one of those victims, Kathy Applin. Now again, this is all according to LeBrage. Quote, in 1983, I started to take a pretty good look at where I was. I was doing a lengthy sentence. Not too many of the things I had tried in life had worked out very well, and I made the decision when I got out that I would like to be doing other things besides ending up in jail. He had become computer literate as well as taken numerous correspondence courses, and because of all this, and despite the things that this man had done, had been given an ironclad release date of 1989. When he discussed the things involving Charles Nung, he stated, quote, I became very uncomfortable with the fact that Mr. Nung had told me these things, the gruesome aspects of these horrible crimes. I didn't feel particularly safe being in the exercise yard anymore, so I requested that I be placed back in exercising alone. Not long after that, Nung is transferred. It's known that Charles Nung spent a good portion of his time while in lockup in Canada, reading about legal cases, learning various laws, methods to file motions, and other things involving fighting extradition. This was because he knew that the state of California was going to try and extradite him, and more likely than not would try him on the murder charges in a capital murder case, which means that the death penalty would be on the table. The first part in the extradition hearings took place in October of 1988. It's known that at these hearings, his friend from the first prison testified, showing off the caricatures that Nung had drawn, as well as describing what Charles Nung had told them about each of them. It has been alleged that during these hearings, there was a meeting held during which Charles Nung told Canadian authorities that he would plead guilty to all of the murder charges were he given a life sentence, and that the California Attorney General John Van de Kamp stated, there are some cases that cry out for the death penalty more than others, and from what we know of this case, that certainly looks like the definition of a death penalty case. The court eventually decides that Charles Nung will be held in the Canadian penal system until extradition can be carried out. Obviously, as all of this is going out around, people are coming forward to the media stating that they knew Charles Nung and were giving various accounts of just what a cold-blooded and ruthless individual he was. Canada eventually signs a extradition charge to have Charles Nung to face murder charges in California with the possibility of the death penalty. Nung's lawyers fight for this, hoping to get the Supreme Court of Canada to hear arguments on it. The court hears it, and then on September 26, 1991, by a 4-3 margin, the Supreme Court of Canada rules that Nung can be extradited to face murder charges. Now, on that date, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police rushed Charles Ng to an aircraft, at which point he was flown to Folsom Prison. Now, Charles Ng is going to, at this point, really start fighting against the California legal system, firing attorneys left and right, and making all sorts of absurd claims in an effort to forestall his coming trial. And this goes on for years. Before all of that can really get into effect, however, on Friday, November 13th, 1992, Charles Ng is officially charged with 12 murders. The deaths of Sean Dubs, Deborah Dubs, Harvey Dubs, Paul Costner, Clifford Parenteau, Jeffrey Gerald, Michael Carroll, Kathleen Allen, Lonnie Bond Sr., Robin Scott Stapley, Lonnie Bond Jr., Brenda O'Connor. And as Charles Ng begins his various legal maneuverings, the state of California reaches out to Cricket and offers her complete immunity from prosecution should she testify for the prosecution, which she agrees to, signing a document on October 26th, 1992. And she does speak to officers, telling them that there was a woman she'd had a dispute with that she had told Leonard Lake might be suitable for the cell. Though she stated that had this actually happened, she would have been extremely worried because she and Lake talked a lot about things and it never seemed as though he carried through on them. She eventually does not really give the officers any useful information. Concerning Charles Gunner, she admits to officers that she had discussed with him possibly using a chainsaw to cut him up and had forged government documents, along with selling items of Gunner's at flea markets. During numerous pretrial hearings, Charles Ng's team attempted to paint Leonard Lake and Cricket as the sole perpetrators of the murders, pointing out the fact that during a period when some of the bodies which were found to have been victims of Leonard Lake went missing, a calendar that Cricket owned had the months that those murders occurred in ripped out, which she could not explain, as well as various handwritten notes she had written to herself discussing the fact that should any of this come out, or if this person learns of it, we're all going to be in trouble, and that Charles Ng was not, in fact, in California during the time these murders took place. Eventually, the trial of Charles Ng is going to be moved to Orange County, going through 10 attorneys, before going to trial, finally, in October of 1998. Obviously, the defense puts on a case that Charles Ng was simply an observer of all of this and had not participated in it, and the things that he had participated in were at the direction of Leonard Lake. The videotapes that were seized were played in open court. Really, the most important thing concerning his trial is the fact that Charles Ng fought for and won the right to testify in his own trial, which, as any defense attorney will tell you, is never a good maneuver on the part of the accused, as that opens the accused up to cross-examination by the prosecution. During it, he gives his altered version of events and denies having any involvement in the actual killings. And he really only admits to having seen dead bodies and helping to bury them, thus meaning the only thing he was really responsible for was concealing murders. Basically, when he was cross-examined by prosecution, everything Lake had said fell apart, and he was never able to give a straight answer concerning his involvement, saying things like, "I don't remember," or something like that. During closing statements later, the prosecution would inform the jury that using his own testimony that, quote, it's never Nung's fault. He always lays the blame on someone else. He was not under the control of Leonard Lake. He was his own person. He was making his own independent choices in the things he wanted to do. Well, the defense spent their closing argument painting the picture that Charles Nung had been under the sway and influence of Leonard Lake and really had not participated in any of the murders, only of the disposal of bodies. Obviously, the prosecution is allowed to refute this closing argument using the videotapes found at the cabin in Wileysville to hammer home the points they had made about Charles Nung, that he was a sexual deviant who participated in these crimes of his own free will and in fact enjoyed what they were doing to their captives. The trial lasted from October 26, 1998, to February 8, 1999, at which point it was turned over to the jurors. On Tuesday, February 23, 1999, the jury announced that they had reached a decision in the case of Charles Nung. The following day, February 24th, the courtroom became packed. The jury foreman stood and announced that they were deadlocked, before stating that it was only on one count. That single count was declared a mistrial. Charles Nung was found guilty in the murder of Sean Dubs, Deborah Dubs, Harvey Dubs, Clifford Parentu, Jeffrey Gerald, Michael Carroll, Kathleen Allen, Lonnie Bond Sr., Robin Scott Stapley, Lonnie Bond Jr., Brenda O'Connor. The only crime that he was not found guilty of was the murder of Paul Costner. Obviously, Nung files motions after this, particularly against his attorneys. He filed malpractice motions against them. These were thrown out. On March 8, 1999, the penalty phase of Charles Nung began. It was filled with the normal victim impact statements from family members, where they described the individuals who had been stolen from their lives by Charles Nung, how devastating it was for them, type of person that they were. There was then testimony for witnesses of the defense, basically painting Charles Nung as a victim in all of this, the victim of his upbringing, of Leonard Lake, all of these things. When the penalty phase had gone to the jury, Charles Nung was able to obtain one of the jurors' phone numbers and actually called her on the telephone in an effort to cause a mistrial. The phone call was relayed to the court, who decided not to go with a mistrial. He was sentenced to death for all of the killings, and he has remained on death row in various prisons throughout California in the years since his conviction in 1999. He has numerous appeals, which, in my opinion, especially given the severity of the crimes that he and Leonard Lake committed, should not exist, as he was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury of his peers of having committed these heinous acts. And so my closing thoughts on the case of Leonard Lake and Charles Nung. I think it is very possible that there are other murders that we are not aware of that they committed. But I think the majority of those murders are directly tied to Leonard Lake. I think the murders that Charles Nung took place in are specifically for sexual gratification, whereas Leonard Lake had an extreme disregard for human life that Charles Nung followed along with because it would allow him to experience this sexual gratification. Again, We know that Leonard Lake committed murders prior to Charles Nung coming back from Leavenworth Prison. Now, there is a story out there that during the time that Lake and Nung were first acquaintance in Northern California, when Lake was running the motel, a neighbor had seen Lake and Nung removing a freezer that had the door on it welded shut. They brought this freezer to a nearby landfill. That may possibly be true. However, in cases like this, we need to take statements such as this with a grain of salt. That, I mean, statements that come out after the fact, after the conviction, years after the crimes are discovered. We need to take these types of things into account, that it could very well be someone simply telling a story that we would consider to be a conversation starter at parties or to sell to newspapers, that type of thing. I don't believe Charles Nung committed any crimes prior to those that we know about, although I do think he probably was involved in other crimes that we do not know about. Leonard Lake, it is very possible that he committed murders that we know nothing about prior to Charles Nung's involvement in them. And I say that because, as we discussed in earlier episodes, it's very rare that a serial killer begins their killing spree as late in life as Leonard Lake did. I mean, he was nearly 40 years old when he was caught and had been committing murders for roughly 2.5 years. More often than not, killers start in their late teens or 20s. And this is not the case with Leonard Lake. So I think that it is very possible and probable that he did commit other murders that we know nothing about and will never find any evidence of. But again, that is speculation on my part, because Leonard Lake was able to live out his sexual fantasies through the various women who willingly submitted themselves to him, most specifically his ex-wife, Cricket. And when that relationship ended and he was put under stress is when we know that the majority of the killings definitely took place. I am going to end the episode at this point. I hope you have enjoyed my coverage of the crimes of Leonard Lake and Charles Nung. Until next time, my Deathcasters and Deathcasterettes, stay morbid!